The last flakes of this week's snowstorm are falling as I'm recording this. And the snow globs are starting to fall off the trees. It's time for Desert Oracle Radio Replay. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm your host, Roxana. This week has been a pretty one with the snow here and there. It's a quiet interlude between busy holidays, and I wonder if you enjoy it as much as I do. Today, I have a couple Desert Oracle Radio episodes for you, one created just a few days ago, and one from December 2020. So, up first, the newest of Ken Lane's productions from the Eldritch Republic series. It's episode 3, released December 5th, 2025. Here is Christmas in Chelsea with St. Nicholas.
From Desert Oracle Radio, this is the Eldritch Republic. True tales of America's strange history and uncanny folklore. I'm Ken Lane. Episode 3, Christmas in Chelsea. Nothing is more American than the Christmas holidays. Santa Claus especially. Of course, there's a Christian saint of the Roman Empire named Saint Nicholas, whose great miracle was paying some money to keep his neighbor's daughters from being sold into prostitution. But that's not a very good Christmas story. Instead, the Northern Europeans who settled the Dutch and British colonies of North America turned the old world stodgy Father Christmas and stern-faced Santa Claus into a charming supernatural visitor from the North Pole, flying through the winter night behind 8 magic reindeer, like white-bearded Odin riding upon his magical 8-legged horse named Sleipnir. And while the cold and snowy New England winters would seem a natural place for such folkloric creation, remember that New England was founded by Puritans and Pilgrims who did not tolerate Christmas at all. They saw correctly that Yuletide revelry had nothing to do with the biblical nativity story. Bonfires and feasting, drinking and kissing games, boisterous singing on the streets, the poor demanding gifts from the rich, houses decorated with festive evergreen trees and druidic mistletoe and the blazing Yule log. Such things were utterly rejected in puritanical societies. Christmas was a sin. By 1659, the Massachusetts Bay Colony had made the celebration of Christmas a crime. American Christmas was first celebrated in Virginia, the Old Dominion, home of the Merry Cavaliers. And in Maryland, where Catholic supporters of the Stuart kings Charles I and II worshipped in freedom and celebrated their great winter festivals of Advent and Christmastide. When the Dutch ceded New Amsterdam to the British in 1664, the folkways of those old-fashioned Europeans became part of New York life, especially those Germanic tales of dwarves and elves and fairies, so delightful to the English colonists, who lost so much of their own supernatural folklore and feast days to the cruel oppression of the Puritan dictator Oliver Cromwell. This mix of Dutch, Catholic, and Cavalier combined in 100 ways to make the unique culture of colonial New York. From the bustling port town at the southern end of York Island to the agricultural heartland of the Hudson Valley. From the Macy's Parade that starts the Christmas season to the towering tree at Rockefeller Center, New York City is the heart of American Christmas time. That's especially true of its American personification. Now known and loved around the world, Santa Claus himself. Almost everything we know about Santa Claus we know from a poem called A Visit from St. Nicholas, which most accounts agree was written in New York City during the Christmas season of 1822 by the esteemed scholar of biblical and ancient languages at Columbia University, Clement Clark Moore. The grand house in the poem, with its snow-covered lawns and roof large enough to accommodate a team of reindeer pulling a sleigh full of presents, was called Chelsea. Clement Clark Moore had been born there in 1779, during the Revolutionary War days and the British military occupation of the city. His grandfather, Major Thomas Clark, had bought the sprawling farmland from a Dutchman named Jacob Sommerendijk in 1750. On today's maps, Clark's original estate has the boundaries of West 21st Street north to West 28th Street and from the Hudson River east to 8th Avenue. The orchards and meadows and picturesque riverfront made the place a true refuge from the wild city below, which was even then known for its cosmopolitan population, celebration of wealth, and a shocking number of prostitutes working the Holy Ground brothel district behind Trinity Church, where ladies of the evening would share their many diseases with both American and British soldiers during the long war. In those times, some 2% of New York City's population consisted of prostitutes. That's around 500 of the city's population of 25,000 during the war years. When George Washington had brought the Continental Army to New York in 1776, his rough and rowdy troops caused all sorts of trouble at the Chelsea Estate and Orchards, too. Well, that's when young Charity Clark wrote directly to General Washington, demanding to know why, quote, the quiet home of a widow and two young daughters be infested by your uniformed, loutish varlets. Washington, it is reported, quote, immediately jumped on his horse and paid her a visit, reassuring her with real kindliness as well as stiff courtesy. Clement Clark Moore, who inherited Chelsea along with his wife Charity, left a lasting legacy in Manhattan, and it's the West Side neighborhood named for his family's estate, Chelsea. Because Clement Clark Moore made his real fortune in real estate, with the Streets Commission demanding he and every other country property owner pay for the new grid that the city ordered built, and more tiring of the city youth wandering into his orchards to pilfer the produce, he decided it was better to parcel off the great estate and move away to the country, to Queens. While he donated the land for the General Theological Seminary that's still there on West 21st Street, the rest he developed with a partner as an elegant neighborhood zoned only for fine houses and gardens. Only a few mid-19th century townhouses remain today in that busy neighborhood called Chelsea. But Moore's lasting fame comes from the best-known American poem of all time, A Visit from St. Nicholas, also known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. Printed first in the Troy, New York Sentinel in 1823, when both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were still alive, and soon to see print in thousands of newspapers across America and around the globe, that poem is the focus of our Eldritch Republic tale. But it wasn't the first New York City poem to be published on the particular topic of Santa Claus. That poem was published anonymously in 1821. And it's called Old Santa Claus with Much Delight. And it goes like this. Old Santa Claus with much delight, his reindeer drives this frosty night. O'er chimney tops and tracks of snow, to bring his yearly gifts to you. Or yo. The steady friend of virtuous youth, the friend of duty and of truth. Each Christmas Eve he joys to come, where peace and love have made their home. One reason this poem didn't become a standard is because it's not very good. Through many houses he has been, in various beds and stockings seen, some white as snow and neatly mended, others, it seem, for pigs intended. To some I give a pretty doll, to some a peg top or a ball. No crackers, cannons, squibs, or rockets to blow their eyes up or their pockets. Wherever I found good girls or boys that hated quarrels, strife, and noise, I left an apple or a tart or wooden gun or painted cart. No drums to stun their mother's ear, nor swords to make their sisters fear, but pretty books to store their mind with knowledge of each various kind. Come on. But where I found the children naughty and manners crude and temper haughty, thankless to parents, liars, swearers, boxers or cheats or base tale bearers, I left a long black birchen rod, such as the dread command of God directs a parent's hand to use when virtue's path his sons refuse. At least the illustrations are good. Lovely little color illustrations, much better than the words. The third of these pictures, titled The Children's Friend, shows a red-suited, white-bearded Santa stealthily filling the children's stockings with treats as they peacefully slumber on a winter's night. The house looks fine, of plain, comfortable American style. Three shelves of books mounted on the wall, a big wooden bed. The children's shoes are neatly on the floor beneath the bed near a new kite with a long ribbon tail. Christmas of 1821. But even that was not the first appearance of New York Santa Claus in print. That comes from America's first great prose author, Washington Irving, in his satirical and very popular Knickerbocker's History of New York. Mr. Irving wrote this, first published in December 1809. And as of yore in the better days of man, when the deities were wont to visit him on earth and bless his rural habitations, in the sylvan days of New Amsterdam, the good Saint Nicholas would often make his appearance in his beloved city on a holiday afternoon, riding jollily among the treetops or over the roofs of houses, now and then drawing forth magnificent presents from his breeches pockets and dropping them down the chimneys of his favorites. Whereas in these degenerate days of iron and brass, he never shows us the light of his countenance, nor ever visits us, save one night in the year, when he rattles down the chimneys of the descendants of the patriarchs, confining his presence merely to the children, in token of the degeneracy of the parents. It was supposed to be funny. Washington Irving was a friend of New York merchant, Freemason, and philanthropist John Pintard, co-founder of the New York Historical Society. Pintard would have been about 12 years old when, according to Rivington's Gazetteer of December 23, 1773, the anniversary of St. Nicholas, otherwise called Santa Claus, was celebrated at Protestant Hall at Mr. Waldron's, where a great number of sons of that ancient saint celebrated the day with great joy and festivity. That was 1773, years before the Declaration of Independence even, and 50 years before the publication of The Night Before Christmas. John Pintard, who abandoned college at Princeton to join the Patriot cause, was also a lifelong supporter of the cult of St. Nicholas, which he also considered an anti-British cause. His years of promoting the festival of St. Nicholas surely left their mark on Washington Irving, who was a member of that same City Historical Society founded by Pintard. The same John Pintard who surveyed the New York street grid and was a chief supporter of the General Theological Seminary, later built on Clement Clark Moore's land. In other words, the creation of Santa Claus had less to do with any lingering old world traditions of New Amsterdam than with these literary boosters of New York City in the first decades of the American Republic. By Clement Clark Moore, this is A Visit from St. Nicholas. 'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, I just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon on the breast of the new fallen snow gave a luster of midday to objects below. When what to my wondering eyes did appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment he must be Saint Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen. On Comet, on Cupid, on Donder and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall. Now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As leaves that went before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle, mount to the sky. So up to the housetop, the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys, and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling, I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk. And laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night." Clement Clark Moore never put his name on the anonymously published poem until 1844, 2 decades after its first publication, when, encouraged by his children, Moore included a visit from St. Nicholas in a collection of his other poetry. Now, many decades later, long after the poem had become an American holiday standard, the descendants of Major Henry Livingston, a relative of Moore's wife, began claiming Livingston as the true author. Well, other than the types of obsessives who waste their lives claiming Shakespeare wasn't Shakespeare, Clement Clark Moore remains the acknowledged creator of this supernatural Christmas tale that sounds as fresh today as it did when Thomas Jefferson and John Adams read it in their newspapers back in 1823. If you are in New York City, you can visit Clement C. Moore Park at West 22nd Street and 10th Avenue this Sunday at 4:30 p.m., December 7, for the annual Christmas tree lighting and the annual reading of 'Twas the Night Before Christmas. with holiday songs from the Blair School of Music. This is the Eldritch Republic from Desert Oracle Radio. Finally, we should mention that Washington Irving and his Knickerbocker's History of New York had much more to report about St. Nicholas's influence over the city. In Irving's telling, it was all St. Nick's idea. The Van Cortlandt clan, those Dutch founders of New York, or New Amsterdam, received divine instruction from St. Nicholas himself. Listen to this from Knickerbocker's History of New York. And the sage Olaf dreamed a dream. And lo, the good St. Nicholas came riding over the tops of the trees in that self-same wagon wherein he brings his yearly presents to children. And he descended hard by where the heroes of Communipaw had made their late repast. And he lit his pipe by the fire and sat himself down and smoked. And as he smoked, the smoke from his pipe ascended into the air and spread like a cloud overhead. And Olaf bethought him, and he hastened and climbed up to the top of one of the tallest trees, and saw that the smoke spread over a great extent of country. And as he considered it more attentively, he fancied that the great volume of smoke assumed a variety of marvelous forms, where in dim obscurity he shadowed out palaces and domes and lofty spires, all of which lasted but a moment and then faded away, until the whole rolled off and nothing but the green woods were left. And when St. Nicholas had smoked his pipe, he twisted it in his hatband, and laying his finger beside his nose, gave the astonished Van Cortlandt a very significant look. Then, mounting his wagon, he returned over the treetops and disappeared. And Van Cortlandt awoke from his sleep greatly instructed, and he aroused his companions and related to them his dream, and interpreted it that it was the will of St. Nicholas that they should settle down and build the city here, and that the smoke of the pipe was a type how vast would be the extent of the city, inasmuch as the volumes of its smoke would spread over a wide extent of country. And they all with one voice assented to this interpretation, excepting Mynheer ten Brock, who declared the meaning to be that it would be a city wherein a little fire would occasion a great smoke, or in other words, a very vaporing little city. Both which interpretations have strangely come to pass. Washington Irving. Thanks for listening to the Eldritch Republic with soundscapes by our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. And thanks for supporting this show at DesertOracle.com. Good night.
Desert Oracle Radio.
It's the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, and streaming at kgvm.org. You might want to visit some of the places Ken talks about in this one when you next head to the Southwest. Ken Lane released this episode December 11th, 2020. Here is the secret desert.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. As the southwestern United States began to boom in population during World War II, a mythology of UFOs and alien life grew up alongside the Sunbelt suburbs of America. Under clear, starry skies and surrounded by vast military bases, the new residents of sprawling cities such as Albuquerque, Phoenix, Las Vegas, and Los Angeles had to get used to the aspects of life unknown in the Midwest or on the East Coast. The adobe and pueblo styles of architecture were adapted, along with the decorative arts, if not the spiritual culture, of desert tribes. Roadrunners, scorpions, coyotes, and longhorn skulls became icons of the New West. And from the Lubbock Lights to the strange craft buzzing around the Lockheed Skunk Works in Lancaster, the reality of wondrous sights in the open skies led to a new paranoid culture, fueled by the Cold War and movie screen UFOs produced by LA science fiction writers. Intelligence agencies and defense contractors did not passively witness this new culture. Instead, the alphabet agencies and their Black Project corporate partners actively engaged with the contactees, the prophets, the pulp writers, encouraging belief in both benevolent space brothers and hostile invaders. When thousands of Americans began attending UFO conferences in the Mojave Desert, most notably at the Integratron builder George Van Tassel's compound at Giant Rock, spies from both Washington and Moscow mingled with the believers, planting new stories and new layers. In what rapidly became a pop religion for these unanchored citizens of the desert cities. Secret aircraft from the first U-2 and SR-71 Blackbird to modern stealth bombers and fighters were explained away as UFOs, especially when they crashed. Better to muddy the waters with outrageous tales than let classified details surface in daily newspapers and on the local television news. Watergate, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and the Church Committee added sinister new elements to the flying saucer stories of the 1970s. If the U.S. government could assassinate its own people, its own leaders, or drive them to suicide with heavy dosages of hallucinogens, could they also be cooperating with extraterrestrial forces? The Roswell crash, only briefly noticed by the national media in 1947, and just as quickly forgotten when the Army explained their crashed flying disc as a failed weather balloon, was resuscitated in 1978 by a new group of UFO researchers ready to find a deeper conspiracy. In 1980, the first book-length examination of Roswell was published, 33 years after the events. The Roswell incident was credited to Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore, and more or less created the mythology that would inspire scores of movies, TV shows, additional books, and websites on the early internet. When a murky government source supplied Bill Moore with photographs of supposed World War II era documents from a secret UFO task force in Washington called MJ-12, it fueled belief in government complicity in a long-term colonization effort by extraterrestrial civilizations. The 1980s brought new forms of media, dozens of cable channels, a fourth broadcast network, and the connection of millions of new personal computers to online bulletin boards, news groups, and early consumer services such as CompuServe and Genie, all ideal for spreading both sincere reports and what we now call fake news. Melodramatic syndicated series about government cover-ups of alien crashes in search of Arthur C. Clarke's mysterious world, etc., led to 1980s primetime faux documentaries based mostly on fraudulent film and video. Movies and TV dramas made use of tropes from old UFO sightings and cover-ups. New eyewitness reports echoed the fictional stories. And a real-life character named Milton William Cooper made himself a prominent UFO researcher. Cooper, born in 1943 in Long Beach, California, served in the Navy during the Vietnam years and made a living at local technical schools before emerging with wild UFO conspiracies in the 1980s. By 1988, Cooper was, along with William Moore, part of a small group of middle-aged men who dominated the alien conspiracy scene. They appeared on television and late-night radio talk shows such as Billy Goodman's weeknight Las Vegas broadcast, which paved the way for Art Bell's mainstream success in the 1990s. And they were busy contributors to online message boards such as Paranet. Bill Cooper eventually blew his credibility within that insular scene and would find a new audience with his deeply paranoid New World Order conspiracies. His 1991 book, Behold a Pale Horse, became a guide for the militia movement, an inspiration to a young Alex Jones. The Illuminati-obsessed Texas radio host, who would later become an informal advisor to our 45th president. But before Bill Cooper changed his focus from aliens to the deeply paranoid and lonesome emptiness of middle-aged American men like himself, and before he died in a November 2001 shootout with sheriff's deputies in Apache County, Arizona, he added to his UFO work by popularizing the Krill Papers, credited to the mysterious O.H. Krill. The Krill Papers confirmed everyone's worst fears. The government knew about the aliens, and the aliens had the upper hand. It hardly mattered that John Lear, the retired pilot and son of the business jet pioneer Bill Lear, had long admitted to circulating the Krill text himself. Lear had claimed that his friend John Grace, an Air Force officer then based at Nellis AFB just north of Las Vegas, wrote this 1988, quote, estimate of the situation based on sincere theories and beliefs regarding alien bases beneath U.S. government installations in Nevada and New Mexico. Upon receiving the Krill papers, Cooper immediately began claiming he had first read them way back in 1972, supposedly while serving in Naval Intelligence. Cooper apparently felt no embarrassment when Lear told him the documents had actually been written 16 years later. As Cooper continued spreading this tall tale, notably on Billy Goodman's midnight broadcast on a clear signal heard across the desert west. John Lear has had a curious second career in the late night world of UFO bulletin boards and call-in talk shows, but he has more or less consistently maintained that the Krill papers reflect the bizarre truth and are not a hoax. The only joke, Lear has written on the above top secret website, is in the name. In the 1950s, it was rumored that an alien pilot held by the U.S. military was known as Krill. C-R-L-L-L, because these aliens apparently lack vowels in their names. The initials O-H meant nothing in particular, although internet sleuths have since decided that O-H stands for Original Hostage. If the Krill papers have a familiar feel today, it's because they fed the paranoid mythology that has become modern American culture, modern American folk religion. Let me read to you from the estimate of the situation. Craft from other worlds have crashed on Earth. Alien craft are both from ultra-dimensional sources and sources within this dimension. Early U.S. government efforts at acquiring alien technology were successful. The U.S. government has had live alien hostages at some point in time. The government has conducted autopsies on alien cadavers. U.S. intelligence agencies, security agencies, and public agencies are involved in the cover-up of facts pertaining to the situation. People have been and are currently being abducted, mutilated, murdered, and kidnapped as a result of the UFO situation. There is a current active alien presence among us on this planet which controls different elements of our society. Alien forces maintain bases on Earth and on the Moon. Millions of cattle have been killed in the process of acquiring biological materials. Why don't they just go to Stater Brothers, you know? Right over to the butcher counter. Nobody looked twice. And finally, the U.S. government has had a working relationship with alien forces for some time with the express purpose of gaining technology and gravitational propulsion, beam weaponry, and mind control. This is Desert Oracle Radio. I'm your host, Ken Lane. In the past week, we got some great news from the Nevada Desert Wilderness. And on the line with us to discuss this is one of the people who very much made it possible for us to get some good news in this department this week. It is the Nevada State Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, Patrick Donnelly. Patrick, welcome to Desert Oracle Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Ken. It's an honor.
We love to talk to you about the work you do out there. And before you disappear into the wilderness for a well-deserved break, can you give us a quick description of what happened in Congress and how the military finally got its hand slapped?
Yeah, well, Desert National Wildlife Refuge is one of the most pristine and intact Mojave Desert ecosystems across the Mojave. It is 1.6 million acres of the largest wildlife refuge in the lower 48, just north of Las Vegas, and it's really a crown jewel of public lands in Nevada. And adjacent to it is the Nevada Test and Training Range, the Air Force's premier bombing range and training warfare exercise area. And the military, for several years, has been pursuing doggedly a massive expansion of this bombing range, proposing to take over two-thirds of the desert refuge, some 1.1 million acres, to drop bombs on and build runways, conduct irregular warfare exercises, build fences, radio towers, and, you know, completely desecrate one of the most pristine wildernesses in the desert Southwest. And a vibrant and dynamic and forceful coalition emerged to fight this. You know, environmentalists, of course, but Native American tribes played a huge role, veterans groups, even the outdoor business types got involved. And the culmination of, you know, years of effort was last week when the final National Defense Authorization Act, the military funding bill, came out. And, you know, it's not so great that we gave the military $750 billion, but the good side of that bill is that there was no expansion in the bill for the Air Force, and they had spent years gunning for an expansion in this National Defense Authorization Act this year. So it was a thrilling victory after years of struggle and, frankly, years of thinking we were going to lose, and it was just a question of how bad. So good cause to celebrate in the Nevada desert in the past week.
Now, this refuge, a lot of people, even desert people, are unfamiliar with the variety of habitats and the extreme variety of elevation, too. Can you tell us a couple of the creatures that we find up there and that have refuge from not just the military, but from the encroaching suburbia of Vegas there?
Yeah, well, the Desert Refuge was designated in 1934 by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to protect one of the biggest and most robust bighorn sheep herds in the desert Southwest. At that time, there were an estimated 1,200 bighorn sheep or more on the refuge. Due to climate change and the bacterial pneumonia and other factors, there's now about 400 bighorn sheep on the desert refuge, but that still makes it one of the largest herds in the desert Southwest. You know, you're talking about the sheep range is the heart of the refuge. It's a mountain range that gets up to 10,000 feet. There's ponderosa pine forest up on top. There are bristlecone. You know, it is a beautiful high elevation kind of wonderland. There's a mule deer herd up on top as well. And the lower elevations of the desert refuge are prime desert tortoise habitat. Of course, our beloved threatened desert tortoise finds refuge at the desert refuge in all of the valleys. And because the desert refuge has been protected for such a long time, it's just remarkably intact. There's very little evidence from mining, for instance, which you have all over both the California and Nevada deserts, very little evidence of mining on the desert refuge, which really means there's very few roads. And, you know, bighorn sheep especially thrive the most in pristine wildernesses. And so that's why protecting the desert refuge is just so critical, because you start building roads, you start building runways, and you ruin something that can't be replaced.
Now, those of us who live in the Southwest and love it, we've gotten kind of used to it over the decades that when the military says, gimme, the U.S. government kind of bends over. What do you think was the real factor here? Was it the coalition that kind of shook them, or institutional weakness, or?
I think there's a whole variety of factors. And certainly, you know, we were cognizant of the fact that most of the time when you go up against the military, you lose. And you don't need to look much further than the California desert for evidence of that. Fort Irwin expanded, 29 Palms military base expanded and took over an off-highway vehicle area. Expansions have happened, and people, you know, the environmental community and others have been rolled by the military. And so we really thought that was what was going to happen. You know, there's a variety of factors. I think the tribal involvement was huge. The Desert Refuge is the traditional homeland of the Moapa Band of Paiutes, the Las Vegas Band of Paiutes, and others. And they were very active. You know, we had a lobbying trip to D.C. We had tribal leadership come with us. They wrote op-eds. They were in the forefront on this campaign as much as anyone else. And I think that was a huge factor. You know, I think the veterans getting involved made a very compelling case. You can't discount the relevance of the pandemic as well. I think everyone's been massively distracted over the past year by the pandemic, almost approaching a year. And in some ways, that was to our advantage, I think. And I hate to say that, but I'm just trying to give you the political analysis here that there was a large hue and cry about the military taking over a wildlife refuge. And my impression of people in D.C. when we went to the Hill to lobby was they don't want a headache from a bunch of Nevadans freaking out about a wildlife refuge getting taken over. Some congressman from Connecticut, you know, doesn't want to be getting nasty emails about voting in favor of destroying a Nevada wildlife refuge, because what do they care? It's, you know, it's not something they want to take heat over. Did that then just get exacerbated during the pandemic because everyone's so distracted, you know, perhaps. So you can never tease apart all the reasons, but I think there were a number of factors that led to this victory.
Now, a couple of years ago, when the threat of this takeover seemed to be, it seemed like it was going in the direction these things always go in, you and I talked about going to some secret spot up there that I don't want to give away on the radio, but that's protected and that's still there now, right?
Absolutely. There are several secret spots out there in the Desert Refuge, some cool little montane ecosystems tucked away into canyons, some relics of the distant human past. A tremendous amount of archaeological sites, beautiful petroglyph panels, and this fantastic valley, the heart of the refuge, is called Desert Valley, which contains a beautiful sand dune formation. And so, you know, all those special areas, all those secret spots, this is really some country that, you know, kind of only desert rats can love this country. It's hard to get to. It's mostly four-wheel drive roads, long, bumpy access to get to the cool stuff. And, you know, it's there forever, we hope. As a wildlife refuge. And, you know, there's every reason to think the military will be back. The military industrial complex isn't going anywhere. The growth of that industrial complex entails a desire to continue growing and growing and fighting wars across the world, right? And so we don't think we're done with this fight. We will be ready for when the military comes back, because the coalition that was built, the energy that was built around saving the desert refuge, also isn't going anywhere.
Well, good. Well, I'm glad we got a victory. It's nice to get a victory now and then. I mean, we've even had some during these past 4 years in the California and southwestern deserts, and land and water conservation bill funding and things like that. So there's sunlight here and there. I hope in the spring when we can travel, I hope that you can break away on a little work trip and go up there and let me follow you and take some pictures, because I've been, especially this year, I've been dreaming of that place.
Absolutely. Well, now that we've hopefully saved it for future generations, I would be happy to show you around. And, you know, folks, when they come to Las Vegas, it's right in Las Vegas's backyard. Corn Springs is where the visitor center is, and that's a 40-minute drive from the Strip. And there's a beautiful riparian area there and great birding. And, you know, while a lot of the refuge is rugged and inaccessible, Corn Springs is available for everyone to go visit. And would encourage folks to do so, because, you know, the only way we continue to protect and treasure these gems is if everyone loves them and believes in them. So that's my pitch for the Desert Refuge.
Well, that's a good pitch. I will link Center for Biological Diversity on the website, but can you tell me the website?
Biologicaldiversity.org.
All right, Patrick, you have a well-earned break in the, I'm not even going to say where, so they can't track you down and give you some papers to look at, but have a good time in the wilderness. You deserve it. Thanks for watching out for Nevada. And you're going to be in the pages of the next issue of Desert Oracle, aren't you?
Well, I have been made a generous offer by the radio host here to include some of my words in the Desert Oracle, and I'd certainly be honored for that to happen. Ken, you know, you're making some of the most incredible and what I believe to be enduring art in the desert Southwest right now. And, you know, what Desert Oracle is doing is kind of, I think, changing perceptions of the desert around the Southwest. So thank you for what you do.
To Zyzix and across the great Mojave Wilderness. This is Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting from Joshua Tree, from our home station, KCDZ 107.7 FM in the high desert. With custom soundscapes by our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Not everybody's in the high desert, thank God. It'd be a bit crowded. And in addition to being on several fine West Coast independent radio stations, you can listen to us on the podcast, which is a podcast of this broadcast. Get it wherever you get podcasts. Speaking of getting things, the first part of the show tonight is from our new hardcover book, Desert Oracle Volume 1. It's out now. You can get it all over the place. Here in the high desert, you can pick one up at Pioneer Town General Store. That's in Pioneer Town. And it's going to be in all of our usual shops up here as the books come in. Thanks to everybody who ordered it online, pre-ordered it from your local bookstore. We sure do appreciate it. I hope you like it. I think it's... I'm going to pronounce it a successful endeavor. It feels good. It looks good. Something to hold on to. Hey, thanks to our guest, Patrick Donnelly, the Nevada State Director of the Center for Biological Diversity, talking about the Desert National Wildlife Refuge. A victory for our side. We'll be back next week, and don't forget, we always have a Christmas show. Thanks for listening tonight. Enjoy yourself wherever you are. Hold on, there's sunlight ahead. And good night from the voice of the desert.
Our background audio today has been the water rippling in the creek near the cabin. Thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver and to Ken Lane for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. I am ever grateful for my fellow volunteers, for the supporters and underwriters of KGVM, and for you, dear listener. This program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio episodes are archived on the KGVM.org website. I'll be back next week with more desert and mountain lore for you. Till then, watch the skies. Keep doing good things. Stay well and sweet dreams. Enjoy the snow. I'll see you next week.